This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell. And coming up on the show, after a controversial and long drawn out voting period, PNG will finally have a new government today. You'll get the latest on that situation right after this. Also, Fiji has become the first Pacific country to officially recognise waste pickers.
I think this is a huge step forward, and hopefully that all the town and city councils will come on board.
30 women now have a new name for their profession, which sees them search through trash looking for recyclables, and you'll hear more on that in about 5 minutes' time. Also, in Solomon Islands, as land clearing efforts ramp up ahead of the Pacific Games, unexploded ordnance is front and centre of people's minds. You'll hear from a surveyor in 40 minutes' time about how that clear up is progressing. First, though, we start in Papua New Guinea, where Parliament will convene today for the first time since the national elections. Incumbent Prime Minister James Marape's Pangu Party will form government after winning 36 of the 80 declared seats. It's not yet clear if James Marape will return as Prime Minister, but the election has been mired in controversy. The ABC's Bethany Harriman has been following the elections and joins me on the line now from Port Moresby. Good morning, Bethany.
Good morning, Jordan.
Bethany, take me through what we expect to play out in Parliament today.
Yep. So coalition government has been camping outside Port Moresby in a hotel, which is quite normal in Papua New Guinea, where they gather together, consolidate numbers, and they will move into Parliament around 10 a.m. today. The same with the opposition. The first meeting of the 11th Parliament will happen around 10 a.m. today, where MPs will vote for a Speaker and Prime Minister. The leading party with the most numbers declared is Pangu Party. They got the invitation to form government from the Governor General yesterday. James Marape is the parliamentary leader of the party and will be hopefully nominated for Prime Minister, but it is PNG politics, so we are bracing to see if there is going to be a plot twist in the 11th hour. The other contender is Peter O'Neill, who is the leader of the People's National Congress Party. There are also other smaller parties with smaller numbers, but lobbying has been going on behind the scenes, and we're just waiting to see what will happen.
And Jordan. Yeah, and as we have seen, you know, it's been a very long process, this whole voting period. You mentioned their former Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, who's the head of his party, as a contender. And talking about plot twists, last week he threw in a Supreme Court action about the voting period. You sort of never know what's going to happen. So how are people feeling on the ground there at the moment? What's the mood amongst the public about the fact that this is finally, they're finally going to have a parliament?
Yes, Jordan, it's certainly a Game of Thrones here in Papua New Guinea. The general public, there is a sense of relief that is all coming to an end, the elections, that is. But there is also concern about the conduct of the elections. Many commentators, as well as the public, have described it as, you know, one of the worst elections in the history of the country. That itself, you know, arguably will be proven later on by observers, international observers who were here. There was violence and numerous allegations of electoral fraud, inconsistencies in the electoral roll. And a lot of people are said to have missed out on voting. PNG has a long way to improve, especially when some of these issues were, as I said, pointed out in 2017 by observers. 2017 was the last election. It wasn't improved before this time around. The possibility of violence after the elections is highly likely when there is a lot of disagreement from candidates and their supporters on how this election was conducted. So security forces and authorities on the ground will have, in various provinces, will have a tremendous job ahead of maintaining law and order, Jordan.
And speaking about those sort of violent incidents, we saw a lot of that sort of happening around also in the Highlands area, as well as in the capital, Port Moresby. But in the Highlands, there are some constituencies where there has been no declared winner. Do we know what's likely to happen for the people in those constituencies and how that might play out?
This is where it gets interesting. There is supposed to be by-elections for places with disputes or ballot papers that couldn't be counted for extreme reasons, whether they are, you know, tampered with or destroyed. One of these places is Payala District, which is, you know, still outstanding. But there are some places that have already had winners declared. You know, the question was put to the Electoral Commissioner, Simon Sinai, about whether it would be a by-election or supplementary elections in press conferences. He says there will be a by-election, but all of those consistencies, well, there were three of them, and two of them were, three of them marred by violence and disputed ballot boxes. Two of them have recently had winners declared, Jordan.
And those two, forgive my pronunciation if I get it wrong, but is it Kabwam and Markham seats?
Yes, Kabwam and Markham. They are in the Morobe province.
I understand there's been, yeah, public criticism and condemnation about these particular seats. What's so controversial about these two particular constituencies?
Yes, Jordan, it's getting bizarre here with these two constituencies in the Morobe province, where ballot papers were burnt in July. The election manager, Simon Soheke, said no counting could take place at the time when we spoke to him, because there were essentially no papers to count. But late yesterday, the incumbent members of the two constituencies were declared by the Electoral Commissioner, Simon Sinai. We contacted Mr. Soheke, but he replied saying it was confirmed the declarations did happen and that the Electoral Commissioner will comment on the decision. Simon Sinai and the PNG Electoral Commission is yet to release a statement or answer our questions, Jordan.
Interesting. Yeah, so still a bit of intrigue, I guess, with those two particular seats. Now, you were saying earlier, Bethany, that James Marape, leader of the Pangu Party that's currently leading, we obviously don't know if he'll come back as Prime Minister, but how do you think the public will feel about another 5 years of the Pangu Party leading the nation?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jordan. Pangu Party still has a lot of support. We can see that through the polls, even if there's a lot of inconsistencies. But James Marape and his coalition still have to prove to the people that they can bring the cost of living down, provide more employment, and provide basic infrastructure like roads and bridges. The country's health system was already struggling before COVID-19. Cancer facilities need to be built, medical supplies need to be delivered on time, and infrastructure improved. So people's needs remain the same. It's up to the government to meet those needs. Members of the coalition said they're giving James Marape another term to do the job. The people's position hasn't changed for the last 30 or so years. They still have the same needs that need to be met by any government of the day, whether it be James Marape or another, Jordan.
Yeah, very interesting to see whether or not, yes, the new government will address those concerns, as you say, for many years, the public wanting the same things and calling for the same things. Bethany Harriman, thank you so much for joining me this morning and bringing us those updates, as you said, on the Game of Thrones situation, of course, with PNG politics.
Thank you, Jordan.
That was our reporter in Port Moresby, Bethany Harriman, speaking with me there. Now, taking you over to Fiji, because Fiji has become the first Pacific Island country to recognise waste pickers in a formal way. The waste pickers in Fiji are now going to be known as the Collection Pillars of Recycling, and the pickers can register with the city council in Lautoka to receive protections. And as Rebecca Chin reports, the hope is that the initiative will empower workers to put an end to the stigma that surrounds their occupation.
Tiki Toro's children are often made fun of because their mum works at a dump site.
I come across some stigma like my children going to school, the students spoiling them, like they're coming from the dump site, and some of my co-workers going to the health centre, and they've been told by the nurse or the doctor just to go and wash their health problem.
For 2 years, Tiki Toro has provided for her family by sorting through rubbish to find recyclables that can then be resold or brought to recycling facilities.
In my family, we have 8 people, like majority are the students. There are 4 students and 4 adults. So the source of income that I'm making the waste pickers, it supports my family by paying bills, buying food and buying stationery for the students.
Stigma and discrimination has plagued informal waste pickers for a long time, but Tiki Toro and 15 other women have advocated for change. Thanks to their campaigning, waste pickers in Fiji have been formally recognised with a name change in order to reduce the stigma they face. They've chosen to be named the Collection Pillars of Recycling. So far, 30 former waste pickers have signed up to the new name and are now formally registered at the Lautoka City Council. Alongside being recognised, they have also been given tools needed to keep them safe for the first time.
What this recognition means now is we're able to provide them a bit of the structured support as opposed to just operating informally. Now we're able to provide them with basic PPEs, training on rights and accessibility to bank accounts, accessibility to saving schemes, to retirement benefit schemes and things like that.
Amitesh Deo is the founder and director of operations at the Pacific Recycling Foundation and helps support the women involved in trash picking with their campaign.
In developing countries like Fiji, we don't have resources. Our municipal councils and private companies don't have all the resources to go and collect all recyclables from areas and bring it back to recycling facilities. So these individuals play a critical role.
The Pacific has long pushed for action against climate change, with Pacific nations being affected by rising temperatures, climbing seas and its share of natural disasters. He says their work is beneficial to the climate change movement through the reuse of materials that in turn help conserve natural resources and energy while also reducing air and water pollution as well as greenhouse gas emissions. But despite their contribution to the environment, they have still continued to face unprecedented amounts of stigma and discrimination.
It's not just the occupation. If you look at who are the waste pickers, they are from the ethnic and religious minorities. So you have people who are largely dispossessed because of historical circumstances based on whatever identity they had.
Kabir Aura is the National Coordinator for the Global Alliance of Waste Pickers. Earlier this year at the United Nations Environment Assembly, waste pickers were recognised for the first time in the International Treaty on Plastic Pollution.
We had tears in our eyes because it was for the first time an environmental resolution recognizing informal workers. It was nothing less than a historical movement for waste pickers all over the world.
Fiji is the first country in the Pacific to take the step towards formally recognising waste pickers, and advocates are hopeful other provinces and other countries will follow suit.
I think this is a huge step forward, and hopefully that all the town and city councils will come on board.
Fiji Women's Crisis Centre's Shamima Ali is one advocate optimistic in the reduction of stigma for the collection pillars of recycling.
TIC is a huge plus and, you know, a huge progressive step forward for them, their dignity and being recognised as workers, as respected workers, and so and giving them back their dignity, the recognition that they should have doing this work.
Shamima Ali from Fiji's Women's Crisis Centre ending that report from Rebecca Chin. Now I'm joined in the studio by our reporter, Carl Evans, who's going to bring us all the latest news from around the region. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Jordan.
Carl, are you a fan of Olivia Newton-John?
I was a huge Grease fan growing up, yeah, and I was very sad to hear the news about poor old Sandy.
I know, yes. I'm too young to have been here for like the peak of her music career, but I loved Grease as well and absolutely loved Sandy. So yes, very sad to hear that news. But moving on to news in the Pacific region, of course. Let's start off in Fiji. Fiji is well known for putting out commemorative banknotes. They did it recently with the Rugby Sevens team to highlight the Fijiana and the Endura as well for their wins. And a couple of years before that, they did it for the Endura themselves because they had their first gold medal. But now they've put out a very different banknote. What is it?
Yeah, so it appears the country's Reserve Bank has issued a new 88-cent banknote, and it has raised a few eyebrows, given it seems to have a little bit of a Chinese-themed design, which we're not really sure as to why. So the note predominantly features the Chinese god of wealth and a money tree, along with various coins, some serial numbering, and the RBF's logo. And it's worth pointing out that the number 88 also symbolises fortune and good luck in the Chinese culture.
And what sort of feedback have we seen, whether that's from people in Fiji or online, to this new banknote?
It's mainly been confusion, I suppose. And yeah, I had a bit of a search this morning. I couldn't find a reason exactly as to why the note was released. But I guess just given all the geopolitical stuff that's happening at the moment, that's probably a reason as to why some people are a little bit confused by it. If all that wasn't happening, I don't think anybody really bats an eyelid. But yeah, it's definitely an interesting story, and probably one worth exploring more.
Yeah, definitely. And Pacific Beat will be looking in to see how people are feeling about it and try and get an answer from the government about why they did put this particular bank note out. And we'd love to hear from you if you are in Fiji, if you've acquired one of these banknotes, because it's 88 cents, but I believe you can buy it from the Reserve Bank in Fiji for 28 Fijian dollars. Maybe don't quote me on that one exactly. But absolutely fascinating. And if you're in Fiji and you're also intrigued by this, please get in touch with us. We'd love to know how you feel. You can get in touch on the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page. Now, let's head over to Solomon Islands. There has been a lot of commemoration recently for the 80th anniversary of the Guadalcanal battle, the World War II battle. Unfortunately, some tragic news out of one of the ceremonies there. A man has been stabbed. Why? What's happened?
Yeah, really shocking news. So the commemoration yesterday was marred by the stabbing of a Japanese military man. So the incident took place at a ceremony in Bloody Ride in East Honiara, where a famous World War II battle took place around 80 years ago. And the victim was part of the Japanese Navy's media team, and he was stabbed in the right side of the neck with a pair of scissors in what was a completely unprovoked attack. So it's understood the man who carried out the attack was mentally unstable, and it's believed he was under the influence at the time, and he was detained by locals and taken away by police.
Wow, that is very shocking. That is very intense. Do we know if the victim is okay?
Yeah, luckily, yes. So Japanese medical personnel spoke to media afterwards and said he would only require minor stitches and was okay. What's interesting is the attack actually took place with a number of high-level delegates in very close proximity, including the US Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman. The victim was seated literally right next to the New Zealand Defence Minister. They were watching an address to the crowd, I understood. And look, while it's okay, I can imagine the trauma of something like this would leave a real mark going forward. So hopefully you can have a speedy recovery.
Yeah, definitely. Good to hear that the victim is okay, recovering well. But yes, I guess that raises questions about even perhaps security of the event and how perhaps someone with a weapon was able to get as close to high-profile delegates or just anyone in who was watching that ceremony at all. You just mentioned there, Deputy U.S. Secretary Wendy Sherman was there. And I understand that she's announced that there's a Pacific Island meeting going ahead with the U.S. president. This has been long talked about and hinted at. What else do we know?
Yeah, that's right. So this came out yesterday as well. And it appears leaders from the Pacific Island Forum will meet with the United States President Joe Biden next month in what appears to be another move to accelerate the United States' diplomatic efforts to counter that Chinese presence in the region. It was announced by Wendy Sherman. She's in the midst of a Pacific tour at the moment. She's visited Samoa and obviously Honiara in recent days.
And on this Pacific Islands meeting with Joe Biden, do we know when that meeting is going to take place?
Not yet, but we do know the details will be announced very, very soon. It will definitely happen next month. And we know that, she says that President Biden is very much looking forward to meeting some of those Pacific Island leaders.
Yeah, and this obviously comes off the back of U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris joining virtually the Pacific Islands Forum in Fiji just a month ago. So lots of dialogue happening between Pacific Island countries and the U.S. at the moment. It'll be very interesting to see what comes out of it. Carl Evans, thank you so much for that update.
Thank you, Jordan.
Understanding China
will go beyond the headlines of trade and politics.
Music is encouraged as an extracurricular activity.
We'll look at China's challenges
and triumphs.
Student-led groups have shown that they're smart, powerful and strategic.
And bring you the news from inside China.
What it's like to be a feminist in modern China.
Get the full story on the making of a superpower.
Watch China Tonight on ABC Australia. To find out broadcast times in your country, check out abcaustralia.net.au.
Cook Islands Environment Group is accusing deep sea mining companies of misleading the public through so-called greenwashing. This follows the approval of several seabed mineral exploration licenses that have been issued by the Cook Islands government. And reporter Adam Jacobson has the story.
Greenwashing is the practice of providing misleading information about how a company is environmentally sound to skew its public perception. Calvin Passfield is the technical director of Te Epukurea Society, a non-profit which aims to protect the Cook Islands' environmental heritage. He says mining companies are trying to improve their image by passing themselves off as research organisations.
If you look at the rhetoric that they use when they're talking or doing things in the community, they won't use the word mining. I don't think you'll ever see the word mining used by any of these companies. They use words like harvesting, collecting, plucking even.
Around 5 kilometres underwater, tens of thousands of potato-shaped rocks called polymetallic nodules cover the seabed. They are loaded with minerals like cobalt, copper, manganese and nickel. Philip McCabe is the Pacific Regional Lead for the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition. He says not nearly enough is known about the deep sea for the practice to be done safely and sustainably.
It's expanding the footprint of humanity, our imposition of ourselves for our own needs upon the natural world. And the nodules themselves are the structure of the habitat that provide space for the organisms to exist. The mining of the nodules is the mining of the ecosystem.
Mr. Passfield says companies running campaigns like a naming competition for their new boat is skewing perceptions around the potentially environmentally damaging practice.
It was basically a way of, trying to pretend to the school children that this is a sustainable industry that we're trying to start here. Mining around the world does not have a good reputation at all. So these companies are trying to pass this deep sea mining off as, well, it's not really mining at all, it's not like land mining.
Mr. McCabe says mining companies are using community events like this to seek social license.
There's community funds being offered by the metals company, but the amounts are pocket change and they're insignificant to the company. It's no cost at all to them, but it means something to the people that are applying for these things.
Cook Island News recently polled 1% of its population about their feelings towards future deep sea mining. It found an even split between those for and against. Mr. Passfield says the poll shows his organisation needs to do more to better educate the public.
If the people think it's 50-50, then we need to do better. But I had to qualify that by saying that, but the government does have all that resource to throw at the task, and we don't.
CEO of CIC Limited, one of the three companies awarded a seabed minerals exploration licence, Greg Stem, told Cook Islands News the poll was misleading.
The question that should be asked is whether people support 5 years of deep ocean research to determine whether or not nodule harvesting can take place without serious harm to the environment.
He says research will be done over the next 5 years to provide enough data to help Cook Islanders and their government decide whether nodule mining should proceed. However, no mining has started yet, with all proposed projects still in their planning or exploration phases. The ABC approached the Cook Islands Mining Authority and a number of mining companies. However, they were unavailable for comment.
Adam Jacobson with that story. Tour operator Dorian Borchards has been scuba diving off the coast of Papua New Guinea for 22 years. But in December last year, he spotted a strange creature which he'd never seen before. He filmed a large translucent mass bobbing alongside him on the reef and posted the video to a jellyfish identification app. When Australian jellyfish expert Lisa Ann Gershwin saw the video, she was gobsmacked because she believed Dorian had found an undiscovered species of jellyfish. fish. Reporter Hugo Hodge caught up with Dorian to find out more about his rare encounter.
Well, when I first saw it, I wasn't sure what it was. Like, I didn't know it was anything different to any other jellyfish at the time, so I just ignored it and swam. I videoed it briefly, and then I carried on swimming past down to the wreck. And then when I went up to the shallows again, then I came across a few of them there. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I've never seen one of these. It's about the size of, or just slightly bigger than a soccer ball. Yeah, it's just really nice colors. And I just noticed what really struck me was the intricate patterns on it. It's almost like an art school, and someone's actually done all sorts of little designs on it. I've always thought of jellyfish as being slow moving and quite clumsy and sort of getting washed around and hitting the reef and getting torn up by the coral and that sort of stuff. But these guys, they were really impressive. They were swimming up current and they were swimming around the reef, you know, and actually seemed to know exactly what they were doing and where they were in the water column. And I'm quite a sort of, I've got an inquiring mind. If I see something, I like to know what they are. When I got back, I thought, oh, yeah, I must have a look what that is. And then I spoke to my wife in South Africa and I said, oh, I saw this cool jellyfish today. And, you know, and she said, oh, send me a picture. And then that's when we actually, she downloaded a jellyfish app and, it wasn't on there. So she sent a photo to the contact us form on it. And that's, you know, that's where we suddenly had a very excited jellyfish scientist on the phone actually asking all about it.
And I took one look at this thing and I went, oh my God, it's huge. It's gotta be highly venomous. And so right away I became fascinated, you know, what is this thing? And, you know, I've since analyzed it very, very thoroughly, frame by frame. And yeah, I'm confident that it's actually a new species. So I couldn't be more excited or more tickled.
Dorian, what was your reaction when jellyfish expert Dr. Lisa Ann Gershwin from the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Service in Tasmania told you that this was something that she hadn't seen before and it was suspected to be a new species that was undiscovered?
Yeah, well, I was just absolutely amazed. I've never thought I'd actually see anything new. You know, you sort of think, oh, well, I'm just an average person. I'm not doing exciting stuff, going exploratory trips and stuff, and I'd never expected to find anything new like that.
Have you spoken to any other locals in the area and found out if they've seen the jellyfish before or known about it?
I've shown it to a few people around. I've shown it to all my dive guides and other people, and no one's actually can remember seeing anything like that.
Are you going to head back out there and try and find these jellyfish again?
I've been out there a lot of times and we've never seen them again. Well, I've been here 22 years and only seen them that once, so chances are unlikely, yes.
If it were up to you to name the new jellyfish, what would you call it?
Oh, I don't know. You know, anyone, I suppose. It's just a human thing to want to be immortalized and have something named after you, but I think I'll just leave that up to the scientists to sort out.
Okay, so you wouldn't go for the Dorian jellyfish?
Yeah, to have a lethal stinging thing named after me, yeah, it's interesting and it's nice, but I'll leave it to the scientists.
Dorian Borchards speaking there to reporter Hugo Hodge. My name is Jordan Fan. Are you with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia? And commemorations for the 80th anniversary of the World War II Guadalcanal campaign took place in the Solomon Islands over the weekend. And the legacy of that battle continues to be felt in the country. Ordnance and landmines from the Second World War still litter the country and pose a daily threat to residents, workers and tourists. The threat has increased in recent months as land clearing efforts have ramped up in preparation of the Pacific Games next year. This means it's been a pretty busy period for people like Stephen Talu, who runs a business surveying unexploded World War II ordnance. His organisation is called Search Pacific, and he joins me now from Honiara. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Stephen, with the Pacific Games coming up next year in Honiara, have you seen that there's been an increase in urgency to clean up that ordnance and make sure there's safety for spectators and tourists?
In the past years, in the last 2 years, there have been a lot of
major UXO clearance work done, especially on the game sites and the game villages, where they'll be accommodating all the participants for the games.
The World War II conflict ended 80 years ago. How much is left over now of unexploded ordnance by your estimates?
By estimates, there's thousands of rounds still left throughout the islands where the World War has gone through, especially on Guadalcanal and Russell Islands, all the way down to Shorten Islands close to Bougainville.
And where do you normally find these unexploded ordnances? Is it out in more remote areas, or are they in the townships? Where are you seeing most of that congregated?
Honiara city, it's one of the fierce battlegrounds during World War II. So Honiara is basically built in a battleground.
And how much of a danger does this pose to everyday residents in Honiara?
The risk is high everywhere. We've seen the accidents last year in one of the local residents where there was a tragic accident on Mother's Day last year. It happened in a residential property.
And can you talk me through a little bit about how your business specifically operates? Do you get called out when there are these sort of tragic accidents that happen? Are you working more on the preventative side of things, mapping out where these ordnances are and then finding them?
With accidents, the response is usually done by the police and the local EOD, which is part of the police, the RSIPF EOD. Currently, there are only 7 commercial companies, including mine, that work in the Solomon Islands, and we do basically work for clients in major projects and infrastructure projects in the Solomon Islands.
My guest this morning on Pacific Beat is Stephen Talu, who runs a business surveying unexploded World War II ordnance. And it's a big job coming up to the fact that there's a lot of land clearing happening because of the Pacific Games that are happening next year. Stephen, how do you personally feel living in Honiara, as you said before, knowing that it's built on a battleground, essentially, and that there are unexploded ordnances everywhere? What is your personal safety feelings like?
It is a risk every day for citizens here in the main capital, especially where there's a high influx of urban drift and people moving in and settling in settlements around the town. And for the commercial companies, you can't take out the risk. The task ahead is very big, and the only way around it is to have a humanitarian demining group to operate here.
And how do you feel in terms of other countries helping with this clearance? Are Australia and other overseas partners doing enough, do you think, to help with the disposal of these unexploded ordnances?
The only help that we're getting is through the RSIPF EOD. I think we have had Golden West and Safe Ground operating here, funding trainings, but it's still not enough.
And of course, increasing tourism is a pretty big priority for the Solomon Islands government, especially after COVID-19 shutting down borders and people losing that sort of income. In your professional opinion, do you think the islands are safe for activities and tourism there?
I guess for most tourist operators, they operate in pretty safe areas. It's in the jungles that we have most of the ordnances lying around in the main city. And 8 years on, it's already 8 years, and we have the UXOs, the ERWs are also deteriorating with time. So the risk is pretty high with that as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Stephen Talu, thank you so much for joining us here on Pacific Beat and bringing us an update of how that clearance is going of unexploded ordnances in Solomon Islands.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. And the Crown of Thorns starfish is one of the largest in the world. Named for the stinging spikes that cover their entire body, they start life very small, but grow to reach dinner plate proportions with an appetite to match. They're the natural predators of coral, and they eat so much that they've become pests that are wiping out reefs in Australia and the wider Pacific. Inga Stunzner has been speaking to Dr. David Williamson, who is in charge of the Crown of Thorns control program designed to protect the Great Barrier Reef.
Crown of Thorns starfish are a natural part of the ecosystem. We call them COTS for short. As far as we're aware, they've been around for millions of years as part of this ecosystem. They're not introduced, contrary to popular belief. And so what we're trying to do is essentially just manage their numbers to sustainable levels across high-value reefs. Now, we first observed Crown of Thorns outbreaks on the Barrier Reef in the 1960s, and we've seen four wide-scale COTS outbreaks since the 1960s.
Just wondering, how do other things like coral bleaching, how does that, you know, and then these COTS outbreaks that are happening closer together, having more bleaching, I guess, how does that all impact on the reef?
All of these disturbance events, they add up. So they compound upon one another. So we're seeing, you know, I mean, there's still plenty of coral on the Great Barrier Reef. It's a very, you know, it is actually a healthy, diverse and strong ecosystem. And it's been there a long time and it'll be there for a long time to come. But it is changing and it is having to deal with increasingly frequent and severe disturbance events. So when we're looking at, you know, the things that we can really deploy at scale to really manage the park, the big things we can do and that we are doing, marine park zoning, fisheries management's a big one, and Crown of Thorns starfish control is a big one. And there was a paper published about a decade ago by the Australian Institute of Marine Science, and it showed that if we could actually keep on top of Crown of Thorns starfish outbreaks across the park, we would have actually seen consistent coral growth over this recent decades. You know, at broad scales, Crown of Thorns starfish control is one of the things we can do to help protect coral now. And every coral colony that we protect from being eaten by Crown of Thorns starfish, particularly the ones that have survived through the coral bleaching events, you know, maybe they got bleached, but maybe they recovered from those bleaching events because, you know, a bleached coral is not necessarily dead. It's just lost all of the algae within its tissues, which allows it to photosynthesize and generate its food, its sugars. Once they recover that algae, you know, bleached corals can survive. Not all do. Some literally get cooked and the tissue will just slough off the coral skeleton and there's no way that coral is going to recover. But if corals are mildly bleached, they can recover. But then if we allow those ones that have passed through those bleaching events to then get eaten by Crown of Thorns starfish, whatever it was about that coral colony that made it strong, that made it able to survive that bleaching event, is lost from the gene pool because we've then allowed a starfish to go and eat it.
David, with the Crown of Thorns starfish, they're a bit of an issue right across the world, aren't they? It's not just the Great Barrier Reef.
These Crown of Thorns starfish occur right throughout the Indo-Pacific region. They have outbreaks throughout Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Solomons, out into the Pacific, Fiji, you know, and as far west as, you know, Maldives, you know, coast of Africa, Red Sea. So, yeah, they do occur right around the tropics and pretty much anywhere there's coral reefs, these things occur. In many other countries, they are looking to start managing their Crown of Thorns outbreaks where they can, but in most cases their resources are quite limited to be able to do that. It's often coordinated through small local dive shops, for instance, that are trying to sort of focus on their key dive sites and keep the starfish off their dive sites so that they've got some live coral to go and show people. What we're doing on the Barrier Reef and within the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park is at a scale that has not been done anywhere in the world. You know, it's an expensive program, but it is protecting a lot of coral and it is really protecting that coral across hundreds of reefs. And that is unprecedented anywhere in the world. And we have inquiries quite commonly from people all around the world asking us for further information on how we're doing things. You know, how do we, you know, what underpins the strategy of the program? You know, how do we choose which reefs we're in, which reefs are out? You know, how do we go about, you know, acquiring the equipment that people need to actually get out there and inject starfish with vinegar? How do we, you know, deploy the fleet? You know, where, you know, all of those things that, you know, that comes down to the logistics of actually getting the job done. Again, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park is really leading from the front in terms of what we do on a global scale.
Dr. David Williamson speaking there with reporter Inga Stunzner. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat here. Thank you so much for your company. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time, 6 a.m. PNG time.